Good morning. I am Hans Gorger Ruprecht. This is CKCU Literary News, our summer program. A warm welcome to Bill Curtin in Aberdeen, Scotland. Among Bill Curtin's numerous activities, past and present, in academia, theatre, television and radio, as a playwright and director of stage plays, as an author of BBC radio plays, there is certainly one which is undoubtedly known to many of us here in Canada. Bill Curtin is an award-winning author of crime and mystery novels, in particular of the famous Jack Carston mystery series, which includes books entitled Material Evidence, Rough Justice, The Darkness, Shadow Selves, and Unsafe Acts, published earlier this year by Fox Chase Publishing. Bill Curtin is the silver medal recipient of the 2011 Forward National Literature Awards in the mystery category for his novel The Darkness, published by You Write On and now available as an e-book and a Kindle edition. Bill Curtin's contribution to our program could be entitled Writers in Conversation about the Creative Process of Writing, because what you will hear in a moment is his conversation with fellow writers, including Karen Moores Clearly, John Hudson, and Helen Burke, whom he has met at the Saint-Clementin Literature Festival in France. Now, thank you very much, Bill Curtin, for your reporting.
There are countless literary festivals held in Europe every year. Another was organized by Gordon and Jocelyn Sims in the small town of Saint-Clementin in the Deux-Sèvres region of France. I've been invited to contribute to it, and while I was there, took the chance to ask a few people for their reactions. First of all, Jocelyn told me how it all came about.
The idea for the festival wasn't our idea. It was our friend Glyn, and he said, we ought to have a lit fest.
And it's just like that.
Just like that. And we said, well, we've been here 10 years this year. We could have a friends round for a pair of us to celebrate that, you know, or maybe even go out for dinner, or we could have a lit fest. And yeah, he said, well, if we're having a lit fest, you two will have to organise it. We feel very, very strongly about the community, the French community, to which we now belong. And obviously being very keen on writing ourselves, and language is very important to us, and reading is very important, and literature and all that is crucial to us, really. We thought, well, it's got to be bilingual. Unfortunately, we came across many bilingual authors, or authors who were conversant with French, like yourself. Mm-hmm. And that made it seem, well, like synchronicity, really. And when we looked at the people who were coming, it just came to me, really, with 3 days, so we'd do an English day, a French day, and a genuinely bilingual day. And that seemed to be logical to me.
Presumably there's been times when you thought, why the hell did we start?
Oh, definitely, yes, yeah, very much so.
But now here we are halfway through, and how do you feel about it?
Oh, very, very pleased and relieved. I think there's been a lot of goodwill. And I think because a lot of the authors have come, you know, just to be here and share their books and their workshops and their ideas, it's created a marvellous sort of convivial atmosphere. And sitting here in this courtyard, the lovely walls and the church and the presbytery and the little garden, it does feel like a little time capsule taken out of our normal vie quotidienne.
And I was going to say, have you learned anything from this? So you'll probably say, yes, never to hold a literary festival.
Yeah, I think that would be very sound advice to anybody in the world.
I don't believe you. I think you're going to do it again.
Well, we're not really geared up. You know, we don't have an office. We don't have a lot of things that you would really... We don't have a mobile phone, you know. How to organise a lit fest without a mobile phone?
Joss's enthusiasm was in keeping with the relaxed feel of the whole festival. In a break between sessions, I sat in the sun drinking coffee with Karen Moores Clearly and Fleur Smithick. Karen's a Canadian who now lives in France, and Claire's an award-winning short story writer from England. I asked Karen what she was expecting from the festival.
I'm looking to get, I suppose, inspiration to do more writing, a bit of wisdom, I think, from some of the more seasoned writers.
Did the encouragement to write come from inside you, or from the fact that things that are happening around you, or what?
I think, as Helen Dunmore was commenting this morning, it's very much a marriage of the two. And I was really encouraged by Helen's comments about writing isn't just about the act of feeling like page in front of you. It's very much integrating everything, all the other areas of your life.
Fleur had an interesting take on the transition point at which she felt she became a writer.
It's just been about getting confidence, really, and then not feeling embarrassed about saying that you're writing, which I have done up until I won the Segura competition, actually. That made me feel like I was actually a writer, finally. And so now I do say it. If you're not published and you have no credentials whatsoever and you're a school secretary, whatever, like I am, you say, somebody says, what do you do? You say, well, I'm a secretary and I write a bit as well.
One of the questions that's always asked of writers is, how long have you been a writer? And they usually say, well, I've always been a writer. Do you not?
I don't think I have always been a writer.
That's interesting.
I started getting interested in it probably when the children were born. They were lovely, but I was very bored. So it just seemed like something I could do.
So it wasn't a compulsion then?
Well, no, it's a compulsion to actually do something that I could be proud of.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, so you could easily have been an artist or a musician?
I think so, yes. Yeah,
so
it's just wanting to do something creative.
Did you learn the trade, or did you?
Oh, I think it's been, yes, by trial and rejection letter. You know, when you're first writing, you do that thing of getting from A to B. But the more you read, the more you realise, actually, you can skip from A to B, or a year, or without going down the garden path. And as you develop your own voice, you stop reading books and thinking, oh, God, I've got to write like that.
Do you think the climate in the UK, where you write, in France, where you write, it encourages you to write? Does it approve of writers?
I think there's a real weird thing going on where they're all telling you can't get published, but more and more people being told they can write wonderfully and that writing's a thing to do. But on the other side, you've got people saying, we get 2,000 manuscripts a month, don't even bother.
Do you feel the same?
Well, I think we're on the, you know, on the horizon of a whole new era, obviously, with self-publishing. Mm. It's a kind of double-edged sword because it can kind of lower the quality, but it also opens up the field tremendously. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that it will kind of gradually bed down, and I think it is a positive thing, mm. rather than all the decisions being made in, you know, in ivory towers in London.
But is there any quality control, do you feel, apart from your own self-editing?
No, because everybody has five-star reviews, don't they, on Amazon?
John Hudson is a poet and filmmaker from England. His track record of involvement in literature in France and in Scotland is hugely impressive, and it's given him comprehensive insights into the two countries' relative cultures.
The Scottish scene at the moment, it's an exciting scene, but it tends to be much more based, I think, about live readings and performance indoors, or printing material and working with the word as printed. In France, I tend to work more out of doors, and I just like the idea of integrating language with the environment. So, and you can do it here, as you can see. It's a lovely,
beautiful
1st of September, and we're in Chatsworth.
Right. Yeah. Actually, how about the fact that the sort of things that we're talking about are, in inverted commas, culture? Do you think there's an appetite for culture still, or is this for sort of people with airy-fairy ideas?
In France, there's an appetite for culture. I think culture is seen as a central strand of the national identity. In Scotland, culture is often seen maybe as more like the icing on the cake or the dressing in the window, and something that is very good perhaps for economic regeneration or the like. And that's not to run it down, that's not to say Scotland doesn't have a culture, but I suspect partly due to its odd relationship with the dominant cultures south of the border, it's become more of a way of maybe an expression of a particular reactionary identity sometimes against that culture in England. And therefore, I'm not sure that it's valued in the same way. I would say that the Anglo-Saxon world defines culture differently from the Latin world.
Well, tell us, since we're on Scotland.
Yeah.
you've got quite a history there of editing and involvement in literature. Tell me something about that.
Yeah, in the mid-90s, I set up a literary magazine called Markings, which I went on to edit for 15 years. And I also edited lots of anthologies and various other things, and getting involved with the Scottish scene. And then in 2004, I organised for the Scottish Executive a whole series of events in France to celebrate what was called the celebrations for Entente Cordiale, which actually was the famous treaty between Britain and France that led eventually to the First World War. Seems a funny thing to celebrate, but there you go. But so I organised events for Scottish writing and writers and publishing right away across France. So that was a great adventure and introduced me quite strongly to the French literary culture, which enthusiastically took up this relationship with Scotland, which was quite exciting. And also I was involved at that point in the setting up of Edinburgh as UNESCO World City of Literature.
You really make the cultural scene sound very vibrant. Do you think? Is it? I know that funding is a problem, isn't it?
Well, funding and understanding the channels that funding might operate through is a current problem. Sources of funding, of course, always relate to social or economic formats for arts projects, and thereby you are sometimes ideologically driven. But that was the same with the church in the Middle Ages, let's face it. You know, Caravaggio, Michelangelo, whoever had to paint what the masters wanted. Right. So I think it can be a good discipline as well as a... So yes, it is a vibrant scene. It is an exciting scene. I think there are huge problems, actually. I mean, if you look at the means through which art has been produced in Europe, let's say, over the last 1,000 years, there's usually been somebody buying that art, whether it be the church or whether it be the bourgeoisie in Amsterdam or whether it be the collectors in Paris or whatever. At the moment, I think the state has stepped in quite frequently as the person that generates art, which is not going to be simply centrally bourgeois. If it's not going to be bourgeois, it's the state that is actually funding it now. And in a democracy that is open and confident, that doesn't pose problems. But I also find that as one gets into economic problems, such as we've got at the moment, suddenly there are directives underneath the messages that you're meant to send out. And although ideologically no government would admit to censoring, and they don't, but at the same time, it's interesting how many good news messages are sent out by artists at times when actually there's a lot of hardship. How certain classes within society are often, as represented by artists, let's say the unemployed, are suddenly not actually noticed in the art world because we're sending out a good news message about the Olympics. I think that there are dangers in any state-led funding apparatus that it becomes quietly ideological, often with a view to saying, well, aren't we all having a wonderful time? And the fact that bankers are behaving like this, and the fact that there is a war in Afghanistan, and the fact... So one can't complain so readily, which is perhaps why small festivals like this are so good, because they're kind of somewhat off the map.
As well as contributing to discussions and giving poetry readings, John had two separate installations at the festival. The first, a film called Toute Direction, had been shown at festivals elsewhere in France and the UK. But when he came to Saint-Clementin to install it, he saw an old 14th century church nearby, which he said was crying out to be used. And the second was created specially for it. It's a perfect synergy between place and event.
I invented a term for the type of installation that I do a few years ago, which is I call them discrete installations. In other words, I don't really want them to be noticed. I want them to tickle people under the arms or make them itch slightly, but I don't actually always want the big Damien Hirst statement or the big Anthony Gormley statement, you know, with statues on the top of St. Peter's in Rome or whatever. I actually prefer to just change the name of a road or change the name of a flower so that it becomes a poem and people notice it as they walk past. And that is a kind of subversive urge, I think, really, just to change the fabric without actually altering the landscape.
That subversive urge of John's was restated in pretty robust terms by Helen Burke, one of the poets who contributed to the festival. I confess to her that I found a lot of modern poetry difficult or even impenetrable.
I think it can be sadly seen to be fairly true, actually, I have to say. Yeah, to be perfectly honest, I think a lot of what's been written is too similar and too cloned effect, and people are bored with it, and it's their way and statement of saying, hey, this is boring and I don't really want to slash my wrist. I could just as easily ring the Samaritans rather than sit down and listen to you lot scuffling your feet and looking at the floor and pretending that you know what enlightenment is, because they freaking don't, basically. So yeah, so I think, you know, poetry really needs a big kick up the arse, in my opinion.
So is it sort of miserableness of poetry? Is that what you're talking about? Or is it the form or what?
Yeah, it's the angst. It's this angst-riddled, oh, God, if it's not, you know, miserable and angst-riddled and sad, it's meaningless, and if you've got humour in it, you know, and it's got to be Sylvia Plath meets, you know, Genghis Khan to mean anything, and, you know, and it really doesn't have to be. It really doesn't have to be. It can be broad-based. It can be so beautiful. It can be so enriching, you know, if you just take it on board a little bit of it, for God's sake.
Sometimes I ask myself, why is that poetry as opposed to prose, which is yeah. Not funny lines?
Yeah. I've been writing poetry for 40 years and I still can't really answer you that question. All I know is that when I write a poem, I get a voice that comes in my head and it has to be written in that certain way where, you can even do those joke poems where the last line ends and it just breaks up into being a poem, yeah, okay, and so that's not longer prose, and you know that's kind of, that was a poem, verbal poem, but so it's kind of swings and roundabouts, really. Yeah, I can't fully answer that. It's stupid.
That's fine. It sort of reassures me in a way. If it isn't so popular, why are there still so many poets? And that again is another daft question, but there are lots of poets that people do or who claim to be poets.
Yeah. I think there's different schools of poetry. There's this horrendous thing which is poetry seen as therapy, and I'm sorry, but I can't be doing with it. If it's not going to entertain me, if it's not going to enlighten me, I'm a bit horrendous. I don't really want to know, you know, that you've just been through your ninth divorce, you know, and it's so, and everything's pretty bleak, you know, yeah. And that does not make it a poem. That does not make it a poem. I think poems kind of land on you from the stars, in my belief, you know, a bit like we'll be talking shortly in the poetry forum about my hero, Dylan Thomas. I think you have to be slightly crazy, mad, bad and dangerous to know. Are we talking about Mr. Byronic man, yeah? But yeah, it's kind of a bit like The Matrix, you know, if you know it's there, then it's probably not a poem.
Although Helen was invited as a poet, her range is much wider. I asked about her other writings.
I like to do comedy. I like things that are going to, like, make people feel better after they've read them. You know, people leaving a reading and chuckling and laughing and say, hey, yeah. Bye, what was she on about there? That was funny. You know, I've done my job. Thank you very much. I do prose. I do playwriting. I'm doing a children's book. I do visual art as well, as you guys know. And it's all kind of happened for me because I'm marooned indoors quite a bit with my boring health, you know. So that's why I've sort of spread my wings a bit, really.
Everything Helen said showed that she's a consummate professional. As well as getting and giving pleasure through her writing, she works at it, hones her techniques, thinks a lot about the processes of producing the work, and encourages others to do the same.
I would craft a play in the way that, you know, like a George Bernard Shaw or Alan Ayckbourn, you craft a play because you're delineating up into scenes. If you're writing a play for radio, it's got to be audibly different. But a poem can just arrive as a little beautiful gift and little gem for yourself. And somebody, I know not who it is in the universe, somebody just says, hey, did you hear the one about so-and-so, so-and-so? And they give you it. And how often do I say that? I often say to Phil, somebody's given me that line, it's barely my own line. So you're crafting a play, you're chiselling and chipping away at a short story, but a poem gives itself to you.
But you just said you get the line.
Yes.
Well, that's not enough, is it? You've got to put some lines around it.
Yeah.
So Yeah. How does that work?
That works like a coat hanger. So you get the line, and then either various of the lines follow it. If you're listening well, if you're not listening well, you go and make a cup of tea or you have a gin and tonic or something while that voice stays with you. That voice might stay with you for 10 lines, for 20 lines if you're very lucky. Occasionally when poor Phil might come home and I've written a 30, oh God, not another 30 liner, oh God, let me just, oh for Christ's sake. You know, and if you're lucky, that voice will stay with you for that length of line. Mm. Not always, ain't guaranteed, no guarantee.
But so it's an irresistible thing, as well.
It is really.
It's a compulsion.
Yeah, it is a compulsion, yeah. I mean, I've been writing since I was 19. I have to write, yeah. I have to write. It's like that mountain thing, it's yeah. there. I have no choice in the matter.
And do you always sort of get, you know, the golfing thing, do you always get in the zone, the cocoon and so on when you're writing? Does everything else cease to exist?
No, because,
really?
No, because I think that's because of my health. Enough ceases to exist for you when you have crap health. And the poem for me takes me into the living world. It takes me into the world where I can run downhill again and stuff. Yeah. So the poem for me is my legs. I call it a leg to stand on. Yeah.
Apart from the mooning and the gloom and doom, 50th divorce and all that stuff in poetry,
yeah.
Anything else about poetry that you regret? I don't mean your own stuff, but about poetry in general, you think, oh dear, I wish they didn't do that sort of thing.
God, where would I want to start? sound like I'm in a real moan, but just the fact that there's like there's sort of schools of it, like dolphins, you know, and they're all cloned to write this, you know, and I hear the same words being used over and over and over again, and I think, and I want to just say, you know, you're not going to inherit the earth. Just get out there and listen to your. If I do a workshop for some people, I'm doing one for the Ted Hughes Festival shortly. I'll be saying to them, you know. Listen to your own voice. I call it making poems audible. And I'm saying, listen to your own inner voice. Because, you know, everybody, all around this table, everybody's an instant individual. We are not, you've all got your own story to tell. And I think people get fearful of telling their story.
Yeah.
And it's my kind of task, if you like, you know, workshop. I hate the word workshop, but, you know, in a sort of meeting group of like-minded souls to say, don't be afraid to tell your own story and use your words.
Yeah.
They are good words.
And are they responsible, or do they think, oh no, I really have got to be miserable?
No, we don't do misery. We don't do shallow, and we don't do misery. Yeah, no. And I would say about 4/5 of people do. You'll always get somebody at the back who's been cowed by life, and it's going to take them quite a few years to come out of that and say, yeah, I can use my own words. Because people get afraid, and the words get locked inside them. And sometimes you just have to stand on a hilltop and scream, and the words come out.
Yeah.
This has been a tiny sampling of what turned out to be a highly successful inaugural festival. The sun shone, there were writers in English and French, and at the same time as they investigated and celebrated the various literary forms, everyone there had lots of fun. Let's leave the final word to Helen. When I asked her what poetry had to offer, her answer summed up what the whole festival had been about.
It offers a chance to be supremely human, and to really understand the self and what we're here for. It offers you that chance, I think.
This is Bill Curtin in Saint-Clémentin, France, for CKCU Literary News.
That was CKCU Literary News, brought to you by the community-based campus radio of Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. We can also be heard on stream and as podcast at carleton.ca/litnews. All our broadcasts are available on demand at ckcufm.com. Please follow us on Twitter at CKCU Lit News and on Facebook. Thank you for listening.